Now for a discussion of changes which occur in the official governmental life of the nation upon the death of a president, we take you to Washington, Bill Henry reporting.
Harry S. Truman, who today became the 32nd president of the United States at one of the greatest moments in world history, is a vigorous, courageous man who will be 61 years of age less than a month from now, on May the 8th. Although he has been in office only a couple of hours, two rather interesting arguments have already arisen regarding President Truman's situation. The first has to do with his number among the presidents. He has been called the 33rd president and also the 32nd president. Actually, the latter is correct. He's the 32nd individual to occupy the office. This is officially stated in the Congressional Directory. Those who numbered him 33rd counted Grover Cleveland twice because his two terms were not in succession. The other matter of debate involves what becomes of the vice presidency. The answer to that is that nothing happens. It just disappears. We have no vice president and will have none. In the matter of succession to the presidency, Secretary of State Edward R. Stettinius now becomes next in line. That order of succession is fixed by law, the Secretary of State being rated at the top of the cabinet. As for the duties of the vice president, which consist chiefly in presiding over the Senate, that duty now falls on Senator Kenneth D. McKellar of Tennessee. McKellar, who is 76 years of age, was elected president pro tempore of the Senate last January, and as president pro tempore, he was the presiding officer during the absence of Truman, who held the title of president of the Senate. McKellar is the oldest senator in point of service, having been a member since March 4, 1917. He now gets a boost in salary, receiving $15,000 a year in place of the $10,000 he receives as a senator. We will have no vice president of the United States until the next presidential election and inauguration. In the meanwhile, regarding President Truman, as a man who is to carry on as commander-in-chief of the greatest war effort this nation has ever known, he's qualified as a World War veteran who saw active service overseas in the First World War and who has kept in close touch with things military ever since. As a man who is to be the chief executive of this nation, he brings a long experience as a public service and county state servant in county, state, and national life. One of his outstanding characteristics is his ability to pick people whom he regards as better informed than himself on various subjects and make full use of their knowledge. However, Harry Truman's personal character is a guide perhaps to what the future may hold. His has been the rather strange experience to have been the subject of many accusations during the recent political campaign because of his former political connections, and still to have emerged with the respect of most people because of his refusal to dodge the issue or to hedge in any way. Those of us who have had a chance to see him in action in recent months have come to admire him for his intensely human qualities. He's a church member, but he makes no pretense of being a saint. He thinks this country is a mighty fine place in which to live. He takes his work seriously. He had no sooner been elected vice president and started to preside over the Senate than he made it clear that he had not in any way changed his outlook on life. He's a practical man politically. He believes in standing by his friends and in having no truck with his enemies. While he was head of the Truman Committee, he did not draw any lines politically, and he calmly pointed an accusing finger wherever the evidence directed it. He's friendly, modest, and good-natured, a fairly typical Midwestern American. He said that it was his ambition to be as good a vice president as it was possible to be, and he has made a point of being on the job in the Senate, presiding over that body with unfailing regularity. I remember going down to his office immediately after a very hot battle in the Senate. It was, if I remember correctly, during the battle over the confirmation of Henry Wallace.
as to whether he should hold the combined office of Secretary of Commerce and head of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Everybody knew that the vote on a certain proposition was going to be very close. And as a matter of fact, the vote was a tie. And because it was a tie, the motion was lost. Senator Taft, who had voted for the motion, then changed his vote for parliamentary reasons, and Vice President Truman, who was extremely anxious to vote no to break the tie, had no opportunity to do so. He said at the time that he was a little sore at Senator Taft for having deprived him of that opportunity, and he said that he was determined never to do as two of his predecessors, Charles Dawes and Henry Wallace, had done, lose the opportunity of casting the deciding vote by being absent at some important moment. Only this week, a similar tie vote came up in a motion by Senator Taft to amend the Lend-Lease law. And this time, even though his vote was not needed, Truman hurriedly voted no in a good loud voice. President Truman has shown himself to be a good fellow ever since his election. He and Mrs. Truman have accepted invitations too numerous to mention, appearing at the homes of personal friends, obvious through sheer honest good nature. There's certainly no tendency on the part of the Trumans to forget the friends of their humbler days as they've gone to the top. Well, meanwhile, the prayers of the nation will go with Harry Truman as he takes office at this mighty moment in the history of the nation and of the world. I return you to New York.
Shortly after the news broke here today, Great Britain and the Empire heard the first direct news broadcast of the president's death from America. The British Broadcasting Corporation carried a broadcast by Alistair Cook, BBC's special correspondent in the United States. Mr. Cook is here at our CBS World News headquarters now to repeat that broadcast, the news of the president's death as it was first heard in Britain from America. Mr. Alistair Cook.
At 12 minutes to 6, the news ticker tapping out a dispatch from Rome about the British 8th Army crossing the Santerno River paused after the letter R in river and waited. Then the bell rang. Once, twice, three times, five, and ceaselessly. There was a moment's silence, and there came a flash spelling out this stark, sickening sentence. Washington. President Roosevelt died this afternoon. That was only a little more than an hour ago by our time, but within minutes, the nation's radios had sent the unbelievable news to desert ranches and Florida's playgrounds and to the factories of the West and to every silent and crowded part of the land. A few minutes after that flash, I was out on the streets of New York. I walked across town towards Broadway and exchanged glances with hundreds of people who looked stonily back. You could only say the sentence over in your mind and feel chilled and empty. I walked through a long midtown street of early evening crowds going to the movies or home from work. I saw only one couple of young girls talking and smiling in a normal way. I asked them if they'd heard the news. They had not. One girl grabbed the other's arm and said, "Oh, my God," with a full, simple cry of emotion that any other day would have drawn a crowd and a policeman to move them on. Down in the flowered square of Rockefeller Plaza, strangers met in little knots. They looked sullen, and then, because there was nothing they could do, they drifted helplessly apart. And at once, in Washington, down there, the cabinet was being summoned suddenly from their desk and starting on an emergency cabinet meeting. Mrs. Roosevelt was giving out the simple announcement that the president had slept away down in Georgia and sending a message to each of her sons away in the fighting forces. Vice President Truman was being escorted by Secret Service men to the White House, an unassuming man from Missouri, suddenly become heir to majesty, as Calvin Coolidge and other small, unassuming men had been wakened in New England 22 years ago when Harding, as suddenly, died. In a drugstore in New York, a manager stood with folded arms while a band played music on a phonograph. A girl said, "You going to leave that music on?" The manager came to with a start and threw the switch, just as the great radio networks decided then to abandon for the time all entertainment programs. Some movie theater managers didn't know whether to go on with the evening show or not. Outside Radio City, a long queue, graver than any American queue could ever be, stood restlessly. One family broke away, and I saw the father make an impatient, impotent gesture with his hand and say, "It wouldn't mean a thing." While you saw all these simple, final things happening about you, the expression of a taxi driver, a student talking to share his feelings with somebody and missing his bus, the first women and soldiers and businessmen straggling into St. Patrick's Cathedral and going down on their knees, the official plans were being announced over the radio. Spoken in a drone, in a vacuum of national emotion, it had been cerebral hemorrhage. The president had been ill 3 weeks. Mr. Truman had been on call for just so long. There would be a service on Saturday afternoon in the White House, and the funeral would be up on the solemn Hudson at Hyde Park, the president's home, on Sunday. But this was information to digest, items of curiosity that had little meaning to an emotional and inquisitive people who now had their fill of emotion and no longer any need of inquisitiveness or curiosity. As I came back to say these things to you, a group of businessmen halted at the foot of an elevator shaft. They had exchanged jokes for years about little boys who thought there never had been another president and never would be, who thought that Roosevelt was immortal. In a way, the businessmen had thought so themselves. And now, they knew that he was.
That was Alistair Cook.